We're continuing on with our conversational expositions, and we're making our way through Exodus chapter 25, dealing with the tabernacle and its furnishings. And today, myself, David Wally, and Nate Wagner, I can remember your name.
That's okay.
We're here together to talk about the first thing that God speaks mm-hmm. about, and that is the Ark of the Covenant. So awesome. When it comes time for the instructions to build, the very first thing God gives instructions about is to build the Ark of the Covenant. Mm-hmm. Let's read verses 10 and 11 right there.
And they shall make an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits shall be its length, 1.5 cubits its width, and 1.5 cubits its height. And you shall overlay it with pure gold, inside and out you shall overlay it, and shall make on it a molding of gold all around.
Well, this is striking. God tells them to make what? Basically a box. Now what's it made out of?
Wood. Says it's made by wood, and then it's covered in gold.
Okay, so a wood box overlaid with gold. How big are we talking about?
Very small. 2 feet by 3 feet.
Okay, no, I don't regard that as very small. It's not like a shoebox.
Well, I have a picture of like the ark.
Noah's ark.
Noah's ark, right?
Okay, but maybe we should talk about this. Yeah. What is an ark?
I mean, it's not a boat? I mean,
no, ark is not a boat. Oh, okay. An ark is a box. A box or a container.
Hmm.
Okay, we call it Noah's Ark because it was shaped like a box.
Hmm.
Here they have this ark where they would put. God told them to build it.
Mm-hmm.
They shall make it out of acacia wood. We know the general dimensions, maybe about 3 feet long, maybe mm-hmm. a little bit more, but right mm-hmm. around that. About 2 feet wide, about 2 feet tall, something mm-hmm. like that. Now, there's been a lot of different artistic renderings of what this, ark looked like, especially mm-hmm. with the lid that went upon it. I think we have one rendering for it there mm-hmm. for our viewers. That's one idea.
Mm-hmm.
It says that it had the artistic design of cherubim on top.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, whenever you're talking about that, the interpretation of what that artistic design of cherubim could be different. So people have rendered it differently.
Mm-hmm.
Some people give it kind of more of a modernistic viewpoint of what that's like. But that's where it went. So now, if you take a look here, starting at verse 12, a little more about it. Somebody read 12 through 15.
It says, you shall cast 4 rings of gold for it, and put them in its 4 corners. 2 rings shall be on one side, and 2 rings on the other side. And you shall take poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. You shall put the poles into the rings on the sides of the ark, that the ark may be carried by them. The poles shall be in the rings of the ark. They shall not be taken from it.
Hmm.
Okay, pretty simple. There was a system of rings and poles on the ark so that when you were going to carry the ark, you didn't contact the ark directly, but on these poles that were beside it. Now, we sort of have the advantage of this, don't we, that many of our viewers, just in the popular culture, they've seen a movie like
Indiana Jones
and Raiders of the Lost Ark is what the movie was called.
Yes.
And the Lost Ark, of course, was purportedly in the 1940s discovering in the desert of Egypt, this Ark of the Covenant. And they have it depicted, which, by the way, the artistic depiction of the Ark of the Covenant in that movie is fairly good. It's a fairly good one if people want to see it. But they had the poles, if you remember that. They were lifting the Ark and carrying it by
most remember them taking the lid off and all those ghosts coming in.
Well, yeah, but that's sort of another matter, right? We'll stick with the biblical part.
Okay.
With the rings and the poles.
Yeah,
what was the whole idea behind not touching the ark?
Well, okay, here's the thing, is that the ark, what did the ark represent? We spoke about this last time, how every feature of the tabernacle answered to a heavenly reality. The ark represented the very throne of God. This is the center, in a representation, of course, God's throne. Nobody thought that God actually lived in the ark or on top of the ark, but they knew that it represented in a very powerful way the throne of God, the dwelling of God, the presence of God. He dwells in heaven amidst the cherubim, and that's why there were the artistic designs of cherubim on the lid. And to reach out and touch the ark was a way of saying, I'm going to reach out and touch and sort of take command over God. God said, no way, you don't do that.
Which is why we read, later on in 2 Samuel when David wants to bring the ark into town. He's got the oxen carrying it, and it kind of starts to wait.
Which, by the way, was a violation of another law. God said, I only want the ark to be carried by people. But David, when he was bringing the ark into Jerusalem, he puts it on an ox cart. Mm-hmm. And then what happened?
He kind of stumbled, oxen stumbled, begins to tip over. And who is it? Uzzah.
Uzzah, yeah.
Uzzah touches it, and boom, immediately killed.
Uzzah made a critical mistake. He thought that the ground would be less, would be more defiling to the ark than his own hand. But you know what? That ground had never sinned or rebelled against God the way that Uzzah had. And so when he reached out and touched the ark in this unauthorized way, God struck him dead. Wow. And so there were very strict ideas about what they should do with the ark and how it should be transported and how it should be carried.
And it needed to have poles because the transportation was very crucial because it was going to move around a lot.
It was going to move around, that's right.
They needed to have it.
Eventually, when they go into the promised land and it's in the promised land for, you know, hundreds of years, it didn't move around much. It moved around a little bit. But yeah, all through the wilderness, it was being transported a lot. Okay, so you have this wood box covered with gold with a special lid on it that is the representation of the throne of God. But they also have things inside the box. That's why it's sort of made as a box. What's that? Look at that there. It's in verse 16.
And you shall put into the ark the testimony which I will give you.
Okay, so that's why it's made into a box. Mm. Something was supposed to be put inside of it. And what was it that was supposed to go inside of it?
The law of Moses. Okay. The law that God gave to Moses.
Right. A depiction of the law, the tablets, maybe a miniature version of the tablets or something. Yeah. But the tablets of Moses, they were supposed to be put in there. Later on, two other things were included into the ark as well, right? What were those things?
We've got the rod that budded of Aaron's, Aaron-budded rod. And
so something with almond buds or flowers upon
maybe
it.
Maybe not the whole staff, maybe a section of it.
Some of it.
And then, of course, the pot of manna, golden pot of manna. Or something
there's a golden pot with manna in it. Now, I want you to consider this, okay? Here's God dwelling between the cherubim. Mm. It's as if he on a stone, he looks down into the ark, and what does he see? He sees the law that no man has kept. Mm. He sees the emblem of Korah's rebellion to show how rebellious man is. Mm. And he sees the manna that he provided for Israel every day, yet they were ungrateful for. And this is remarkable. When God looked down and looked down into the ark, so to speak, all he saw with these emblems of man's sinfulness and weakness and man's inability to obey God's holy standard.
Except that we're forgetting one piece of the ark, right?
What are we forgetting?
The mercy seat.
The lid. You see, the lid is so important that it's given its own description, starting here at verse 17. So somebody read here verses 17 through 22.
It says, "You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold. 2.5 cubits shall be its length, and a cubit and a half its width. And you shall take 2 cherubim of gold, of hammered work you shall make them at the 2 ends of the mercy seat. Mm. Make 1 cherub at one end, and the other cherub at the other end. You shall make the cherub at the 2 ends of it of one piece with the mercy seat. Mm. And the cherub shall stretch out their wings above, covering the mercy seat with their wings, and they shall face one another. The faces of the cherubim shall be toward the mercy seat. You shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony that I will give you. And there I will meet with you, and I will speak with you from above the mercy seat, from between the 2 cherub, which are on the ark of the testimony, about everything which I give you in commandment to the children of Israel."
Wow. Okay, so the mercy seat's so important because in symbolic way, it stands in between God and the broken law and the rebellion and their ungratefulness. Mm. And it's given its own description as a separate piece. Yeah. Now, what would they do with the mercy? By the way, you can sort of see a depiction here on our screen of what the mercy. It's its own thing. It stands separate. It's a separate part of the Ark of the Covenant.
It's all one piece. It's all pure gold.
Pure gold, not wood.
Not wood
with
at all.
Gold. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay, so what was the role of the mercy seat, let's say, on the Day of Atonement?
Well, wasn't the blood of the sacrifice poured or placed or sprinkled on top of that mercy seat?
That's right. That's right. To me, this is an amazingly powerful picture. Dave, why don't you explain it?
Well, it's almost the picture is that God is in heaven,
right,
looking down upon these pieces that are within the ark, but he doesn't see them directly to the pieces, but he looks at them through kind of this lens of the blood of the sacrifice that covers the pieces or the things that are in the ark?
The covering blood, which is significant because the whole concept of atonement in the Old Testament is the idea of covering.
Yeah.
And that's what it did. The blood of sacrifice covered over man's sin and rebellion and ungratefulness, and it is the atonement that we need.
Wow.
And this is transferred over to the New Testament. Don't we find it written very specifically in the book of Hebrews that Jesus Christ is our mercy seat?
Yeah.
He stands between our brokenness and God's holiness and provides that atonement that we need.
It's almost like God looks at us through the lens of Jesus'
exactly.
blood. It's like Jesus' blood stands between us and God.
Yeah.
Yes.
And because of his blood, we're seen not as rebellious, not as sinful, but in his perfection, in his righteousness.
That's why the translators of the Hebrew Bible into the ancient Greek language, the Septuagint, they chose a word that basically means the place of propitiation, where God is satisfied, where his holy requirements are fulfilled. That's what they called the mercy seat.
Wow.
It's something really special, really remarkable.
At the same time, that's happening, and then he makes this remark at verse 22, and there I will meet you.
Yes.
I will speak with you from above the mercy seat. I mean, that's...
What? Now, that's interesting because did God meet with Israel at the mercy seat? Absolutely.
Right.
Did he meet with them every day at the mercy seat?
No, I don't believe so. Just was it just one day a year, one man able to come in?
Isn't that a mind-blowing thing? Mm. That this Ark of the Covenant stood in the Holy of Holies, which we're going to talk about when we talk about the tabernacle a little bit later, stood in the Holy of Holies and no man saw it. Only one man once a year could go behind that veil and apply the sacrificial blood to the Ark of the Covenant. And so the idea was of distance between God and man. God wanted to connect with man, but the sinfulness makes a distance. But once a year, it can be atoned for. It can be covered over. Now we have a permanent covering in Jesus Christ. And this is, don't we see Jesus fulfilling this idea of the Ark of the Covenant? I mean, God, there's a sense in which Jesus leaves the throne in heaven and comes down to earth and walks among us. And then makes his life the sacrifice, the mercy seat, the atonement that you and I need for our sins.
But then one day he's also ascended.
Yes.
Again into the throne.
Yes. And in some way, that we can't really, I think we can only think of it in by analogy almost. Jesus Christ goes in heaven before God with sacrificial blood, with atonement, and offers it before the throne of God the Father in heaven, and fulfills the rituals connected with the Ark of the Covenant perfectly.
Yeah.
All right, one more thing. What happened to the Ark of the Covenant?
Well,
Indiana Jones
found it. Right, it's in a warehouse. It's in some army warehouse somewhere.
Yeah. Stamped and placed.
Well, no, obviously that's just a fiction, but according to most historians, nobody knows what happened to the Ark of the Covenant after the destruction of Solomon's temple in, gosh, I should have the date in mind, 640-something B.C., whatever it was. Nobody knows what happened. There are legends that Jeremiah, the prophet, hid it in some of the many caverns and caves that are underneath the Temple Mount, but that obviously hasn't been verified.
So in the times of days of Jesus in Herod's temple, there was no Ark of the Covenant.
The Holy of Holies was empty.
Wow.
Isn't that a mind blower?
Wow.
And I've heard, I think there's different viewpoints on this, I've heard that what they did with the Blood of Atonement was they just sprinkled it on the veil. So we can't say, I would say that there's at least a possibility that the Ark still exists.
Wow.
Covered in gold, it wouldn't decay. And the reason why I say this is that we believe that sometime before the end, there's going to be a rebuilt temple. Would it not be an amazing impetus to build the temple if they were happened to find the Ark of the Covenant?
Yeah, we got to build the temple now.
That's right. You've got to build it because, you know, here it is. Well, who knows? At least there's a possibility of that existing. But more than anything, it looks to Jesus and his great work for us. So let's pause here, and then we'll come back again following on in chapter 25 and continue on our in-depth look at these different vessels.